Yep.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Good to see you all. Wonderful. Nice to see some familiar faces. All your familiar faces. Great. Thank God. Wonderful, wonderful. So tonight, I've gotten feedback from some of you that you're enjoying it and the class. But you go after we get off, you have a headache because I'm throwing so much at you, things that you may never have heard before, and you have a headache. So my first response is tough. That's the way it goes. You just have to live with it. That's what I do. But then I took a step back and the more kindler, gentler me said, okay, why don't we do something that will be a little less strenuous? So for tonight, the topic, since we're in the living room, dining room area, the topic tonight is a mitzvah that you're all familiar with. In Hebrew, it's known as Hachnasat Orchim, welcoming guests. We've all had guests in our home, whether it's for Shabbat meals or just in general, having people helping take care of people who are traveling, and we welcome them into our home. This is a bona fide mitzvah in the Torah. This is not just a nice idea. It's not just a matter of, well, it's a good character building. It is an explicit mitzvah in the Torah under the general category known as chesed, kindness. That's really where this goes. This mitzvah of achnasat archim of welcoming guests. But I want to at least begin with an understanding of just how pivotal a mitzvah this really is. So there is a section of Mishnah. There's a section of Mishnah that discusses certain mitzvos where we have a general concept. Let me take a step back. A general rule. The reward for doing any mitzvah is not paid back in this world. As a general rule, again, there are some exceptions we'll see in a moment, but as a general rule, when we perform a mitzvah in this world, there is no expectation that we will get rewarded for it in this world. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense logically. How much would you sell me, Susan, would you sell to me a mitzvah that you did today, yesterday, whatever it was, would you sell it to me for $50? I'll give you $50. You sell me the reward for doing that mitzvah.
No.
You wouldn't sell it. How about for $100?
No.
$1,000?
Yeah.
There's no amount of money you would take.
No.
Really? Come on. You know the answer is higher than that. You would do it.
I would not do it.
For $1,000,000.
Maybe if you took Noah for 2 months, maybe, possibly. But no, I would not.
There's no amount of money you would take. Anybody, no. would you trade it in? Liz, would you trade it in? No, it's funny. We never maybe have thought about it, but you're correct because the truth of the matter is the value of doing a mitzvah cannot be compensated adequately in this world. There's not enough money in the world because what a mitzvah is that you have connected to God. You have connected to this almighty being and you have fulfilled that request. That command to do something positive. There's no amount of money that makes it worthwhile. Yes, I know. They always say money is the root of all evil. And then the second half of it goes, yeah, but it's the evil I'm rooting for. There's truth to that. But you wouldn't sell your mitzvah. So listen, so as a rule, any mitzvah that we do not expect reward in this world because, as I said, you can't, it's not adequate. In the world to come, in that world, after the Messiah, after that, entering into that next level world, that's the reward world, the world of collecting reward. Simply put, for those who like to gamble, if you go to a casino, so what do? Is you play the games, whether it's the slots or whether it's the blackjack or whatever it is, and you amass a certain amount of tokens. You win. What do with those tokens? You cash them in. Think of it that way. In this world, we're in the casino, and the goal of it, is to amass as many tokens as possible, but you can't cash them in at the slot machine. You have to cash them in where you get the reward. That's at the cashier or whatever it is, right? For my teenagers, when I talk about this concept, I talk about Dave and Buster's. You get your tokens, mm-hmm. right? But you don't go and you don't get the reward. You don't get the prize right there at the game. You take your card and you collect it at the prize table. And then you get to choose based on however many points you got, right? So there is no way that any mitzvah can be rewarded in this world. However, and I'm going to read you this Mishnah. It's really important. Just like when you have a stock, there are certain stocks that pay dividends in this world. You have a stock where the principal remains intact. The value of the stock stays the way it is. Maybe it's in a trust, but it generates interest. It generates a dividend. There are certain mitzvos in this world whose principle remains for the world to come. The reward for doing that mitzvah is not in this world. That's for the next world. But there are dividends that are paid here. Certain mitzvos are of that caliber. Here's what it says. These are the precepts. These are the mitzvos whose fruits a person enjoys in this world, but whose principle remains intact for him in the world to come. Listen to this listing. They are the honor due to father and mother when we honor parents, acts of kindness, early attendance at the house of study morning and evening, hospitality to guests, visiting the sick, providing for a bride, escorting the deceased, absorption in prayer, bringing peace between man and his fellow, and the study of Torah is equivalent to them all. This is a pretty hefty list of seriously, you know, big time mitzvah. But snuck in there in the middle is this mitzvah of providing hospitality to guests. This isn't just a nice thing. It is a major, major component, a major mitzvah that literally pays dividends in this world. So where do we turn to in the Torah to learn how to do this mitzvah? Where would be a place that you would cite as a good source for us to learn? Where would you turn to?
What Abraham did.
Excellent. Perfect, Robin. We would turn to the famous story of the Abraham sitting at the tent in a hot day, and he's waiting for travelers to come and go. This was right after he had his circumcision. And what are we told? Here's what we have. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and saw, behold, three men were standing over him. He perceived, so he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed toward the ground. And he said, my Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Let some water be brought and wash your feet and recline beneath the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourself. Then go on, inasmuch as you have passed your servant's way. They said, do so just as you have said. Okay, we agree. We'll come in. Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, hurry quickly, three sa'as worth of meal, fine flour, knead and make cakes. Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, tender and good, gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. He took cream and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed these before them. He stood over them beneath the tree and they ate. And then they get into a conversation, and these, which Abraham doesn't know, are angels. They give him the wonderfully good news that Sarah is going to become pregnant and she's going to have Isaac in a year's time. We're all familiar with this story. But if you analyze certain aspects of this story that I think many of us may have missed when we went through it the first time in Hebrew school, or even the first time later. Remember, this is the advanced class. No more easy. This is not Judaism 101 anymore. We have moved up to the upper level. Let's start with the basics. Abraham is distressed that he has no visitors, even though it's the third day since his circumcision, which physically is one of the most draining days after any surgery. He's distressed. He has no guests. It's exceptionally hot. Why? Hashem purposely did it that way so that there would be no travelers. There wouldn't be any guests so Abraham can truly recuperate. But Abraham's not happy. He wants to do the mitzvah. He wants guests. So what does God do? He sends three angels for Abraham to interact with and to provide food for. Correct? Do I have this right so far? Can I ask you a simple question? And tell me honestly if you've thought of this question before. Why does God send angels who don't eat anyway? Why doesn't God put the hot sun back in its compartment, cool it down, and then guess what? Real bona fide travelers will come by. Why is this cockamamie setup of where God has it burning hot and he goes ahead and makes a charade of sending angels so they look like humans so that Abraham can feed them? They're not eating anyway. Why set this up in such a way? Just make it simple. Create a storm. You know, like here in Maryland during the summer, you get this storm. It comes through and it drops 10 degrees for about 3 minutes, right? And then we go back. That's what should have been. Then you'll have real travelers. Tell me if you've ever asked this question before. Have you thought about it? Me neither. Me neither. It's such a great question. Alan loves it. He is like licking his chops. He is like, yes. It's a great question. Let's take a little detour. Let's tell another story. This is the famous story of Ruth. Story of Ruth, which we read on the holiday of Shavuot, right? Because Ruth is the ancestor of King David. King David, who passed away on his birthday and passing away was on Shavuos. So we read the book of Ruth for many reasons. But let me read you one section. I'll just give you a quick recap. This lady, Ruth, she is married. Her mother-in-law, her father-in-law, she has a sister-in-law. There's a man by the name of Elimelech. His wife's name is Naomi. Elimelech and Naomi, they have two sons. One marries Ruth, and one marries Orpah. These are the two. Okay? Long story short, they do very well. They're very well off, and there's a famine in the land, and they have no choice. They leave, they go out, and they leave the whole country. First son dies, second son dies. So now you have two daughters-in-law. And by the way, the father, Elimelech, dies. So all you have left are the women. You have Naomi, the mother-in-law, and her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. They have nothing left. Naomi decides she's got to go back home to the land of Israel, and she gives her daughters-in-law basically the option to go back home. There's no reason for them to go follow her back. She's penniless, and she has no more sons. So go home. Go find a nice shidduch back home and go back to your old ways. There's nothing I have for you. Orpah says, great idea, and she turns around and walks away. But Ruth says, no. Where you go, I go. Where you stay, I stay. I will follow you to the end of the earth, Naomi. Fine. The two of them come back. They're penniless. And Ruth has to go glean food from those who are able to grow stuff. And she ends up, a long story short, she ends up in a man named Boaz. Ends up in Boaz's field. And she brings home, she's able to eat from the food that's in that field. And she's able to bring a little bit back for her mother-in-law as well. Here's what the verse tells us. That might be the fastest recap I've ever had of the story of Ruth. There's a lot that goes on there. Here's what it is. Okay. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and she beat out what she had gleaned. It came to about an ephah of barley. Not a lot. Not a lot. She carried it and came to the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she took out and gave her what she had left over after eating her fill. Where did you glean today? Her mother-in-law asked her. Where did you work? May the one that took such generous notice of you be blessed. Okay. Naomi gives a blessing to whoever was kind enough to provide Ruth and Naomi the food to survive that day. Listen to Ruth's response. So she told her mother-in-law, whom she had worked by, and said, "The name of the man by whom I work today is Boaz." Seems very straightforward. The name of the man by whom I work today is Boaz. That's a nice translation if you want to get the storyline right. However, you've been with me long enough to know that what do you got to do to get the real understanding? Read it in the original. The wording is slightly, as you will see, drastically different than just the loose translation. The words are as follows. She says to her mother-in-law, Esa sher asasa imo, right? That which had happened, imo with him. Vatomer, and Ruth says, Shem ho'ish, the name of the man, asher asiti imo hayom, that I did with him today, Boaz. His name is Boaz. I'll say it again carefully. The English translation has it as the name of the man by whom I worked today is Boaz. But the translation literally is the man that I worked with him, meaning I did for him today. His name is Boaz. There is a world of difference. The meaning of the verse is the one who did me a favor and I was able to work. However, our sages pick up on the grammar and they point out that if you examine the words very carefully, the phraseology suggests that Ruth did something for Boaz, not Boaz did something for Ruth. That's the literal. Asher asiti imo, I did for him today. Really? Last I checked, you came penniless. You came into my field. I'll play Boaz, right? You came into my field and I provided for you. Why does Ruth use the phraseology as if implying she did something for Boaz? So our sages pick up on this and teach us this principle. Yoter mima shebal habayit osa im ha'ani, more than what the landlord does for the poor person, ha'ani osa im bal habayit. The poor man does more for the host, for the landlord. You hear that? More than what the landlord provided for the poor person, which is a lot. She doesn't have what to survive without it. It doesn't compare to what the poor person now facilitated and gave to the host, to the landlord who gave. Who received more? The poor person? No, say our sages. The one who received more, who got the better end of the bargain, got the better end of the deal, was the landlord. The giver ends up getting more than the taker. It's counterintuitive, but that is the fact. In fact, it's really a verse in the Torah itself. But again, if you're not primed to see it that way, you just gloss over it. The Torah tells us a story. It tells us, Ki yiyeh b'cha evyon, when you have a destitute person and they need your help, naton titen lo, you shall give to him, provide for him, whether it's money, clothing, whatever they need. Why? The next verse reads, Ki biglal hadover hazeh, because of this matter, Yevarechecha Hashem Elokecha, God will bless you, v'chol maase yadecha, with all the work of your hand, uv'chol mishlach yadecha, and whatever you set your hand to do. Who's the bigger beneficiary, says the Torah? What you gave 10 bucks, you gave 100 bucks to the poor person, you're going to come out 10 times better.
Because the mitzvah is worth more than anything that was given away.
Correct. Not just the mitzvah. This is a unique piece, Liz. And that is, you will monetarily in this world benefit more than what you gave. It is one of the unique cases It's more in regards to tzedakah. I know we're talking more about welcoming guests, which is under a similar category. But when it comes to giving tzedakah, which in English they translate as charity, there's a unique concept. You're not allowed to, under normal circumstances, I cannot make a deal with God. I cannot look to God and say, hey, if you let me win the lottery, I will become Shomer Shabbos. You can't do that. There's no deal like that. God is not into playing games like that. There's only one exception to that rule. And that is when you say, if I give money as charity, as tzedakah, you give me in return more. Test me, God says. Test me. You give away some of your money, try me. I'll give it back to you in spades. That's a rule. You can't do that for anything else. I told you this joke last week. The guy who's, I think I told you last week, the guy is desperate to get to his interview, right? He has a big interview. I think I told this to you. Yeah, whatever. Okay. You listen to the tape. Who was there? Okay. Right? You can't make deals with God, except when it comes to money like that. If I give, I expect you, God, to pay me back much more. Boaz is the bigger recipient more than Ruth. So now, in the premier chapter that teaches us about hachnasat archim, of welcoming guests, right? What are we told? We're told about people who don't need it. Why? Because the lesson is that the host needs to remember that he or she is the one who's really gaining in all of this. The recipients, whatever they get, if anything, is insignificant in comparison to what you get for giving. Therefore, yes, Hashem could have brought a storm that would have cooled it off and regular travelers. But then I might have thought, look, they gained so much. No. Hashem purposely sends angels that get zero benefit because that's not the big picture. In the big picture, the poor person, the traveler, the one you took in as a guest, doesn't really receive anything in comparison to what you receive as the giver. And therefore, in this chapter that's describing welcoming guests and the details of it, it specifically, Hashem chooses a case that ultimately the one who needs the mitzvah receives way more than what he gives out. What a great insight about how this is set up. But wait, there's more. I want to read you the text one more time. Okay? I'll read you from the beginning of that chapter. And I want you to tell me what is missing. What is really missing in this story? Listen carefully. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eye. Do you want me to put the emphasis on a certain syllable so you can get it quickly? Okay, here we go. I'll try again. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and saw, behold, three men were standing over him. He perceived. So he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed toward the ground. And he said, my Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from the servant. Let some water be brought, wash your feet, and recline the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourself. Then go on, and as much as you have passed your servant's house, they said, do so just as you have said. What's missing?
God.
No, God's there.
But he's not talking.
Okay, that's good. But something critical.
Isn't Sarah doing a whole lot of work?
Well, first tell me, who's he?
Abraham.
Bro, don't you think it would be nice to get his name in here somewhere? Tell the whole story, and even the first sentence uses a pronoun. How do I know who we're talking about? And it almost as if it's going out of the way not to say his name. Five verses in a row use pronouns. This is the beginning of a new parsha. It's not like, oh, I just finished about Abraham and now I'm just continuing. This is a new parsha. I haven't heard Torah in a week since last Shabbos. No mention of his name? It's not until verse 6. So Abraham hastens to the tent to Sarah. Now Liz's point, they have their conversation and what to do about providing the food. But the first 5 sentences of the story, no mention of his name. That's weird. That's just flat out weird.
Is it to try to make
a place like that? What, Fred?
Is it to try to make a point that we're now talking to you as opposed to a story of Abraham? This is what will happen. This is what you should do. You know, is it meant to be read that way?
I don't know if I would phrase it exactly like that, but I think your point is very well taken in that there is a profound lesson for us how to do this mitzvah. Yeah. I'm with you.
That's what I meant to say.
Yeah, there is a profound lesson about the mechanism by which how we do this mitzvah. What were you going to say, Wayne?
Well, I was going to agree with him. Hashem is giving you the direction as a person that what you should do to honor or to invite guests in the same manner and make them feel welcome and don't make them feel like they're intruding on you.
Fabulous. It's almost as if the Torah is saying, do this mitzvah anonymously. Don't make it all about you. Look what I'm doing. I'm doing this and I'm doing that. No, it's not all about you. The way to do hospitality, the way to do kindness for another person is that the guest should not be made to feel that the host is personally being made to serve him, because they're not comfortable with that. Listen to a great story. I love this story. A story is told about the legendary hospitality and amazing sensitivity of Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, the great tzaddik and spiritual leader of early 20th century Jewry in Israel. One Passover, some guests from outside the Holy Land came to visit Jerusalem, and they asked to join Rabbi Sonnenfeld and his family for the Passover festival. He graciously agreed to their request and brought them to his home. Just to be cordial, the guests offered the rabbi some money to help defray the huge expenses of hosting the Passover Seder, and much to their surprise, he immediately accepted their offer. They promptly gave his wife 5 liras sterling, and they settled into their rooms. It was on the first day of the intermediate days of the festival, when the guests were about to leave, Rabbi Sonnenfeld suddenly appeared at the door to their room with the 5 liras sterling, which they had originally given him, and he placed it on the table in front of them. The guests were both surprised and confused. They had thought that the rabbi had willingly accepted their offer to pay for part of the food that they would be eating at his home. And here he was returning all their money to them unused. Rabbi Sonnenfeld explained his strange behavior to them. He said, listen to these words, sweet as honey. When you offered to pay for your meals, I realized that you didn't feel good about taking other people's food for free. And I knew that you would have limited how much of my food you were going to eat, thus not being able to enjoy the holiday meal properly. I therefore allowed you to give me the money, which in turn enabled you to eat to your heart's content, thinking as you are that you were paying for part of it. But now that you have completed your stay at my home and are preparing to leave, I'm returning your money as I had no intention whatsoever of actually taking money from you in exchange for the tremendous opportunity to perform the mitzvah of Achnasas Arkham. Isn't that a great story? Oh, yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
The sensitivity. You're not the object of my mitzvah performance. My observance is not because you, I have a guest. Yay, I can mark that off my list. Way to go, T. That's not what this is about. This is about being sensitive to the needs of others. And if it means doing it quietly, then so be it. The first, excuse me. The first 5 verses in the premier story of how to do a Hachnasas Arachim is anonymous. Doesn't say his name because it's not about Avraham performing it. It's about the guest's needs. Love that story. But wait, I think it gets even better. When does his name finally appear? When does the Torah say, okay, now I'll introduce you? Right? Obviously, it's got to be with a choice. I could have done just the first two verses. You would have gotten the message across. But it waits to a certain point. So Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, hurry, 3 saws of meal, fine flour, knead and make cakes. Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. Where is there a change? When he's starting to encourage his family to get involved in this mitzvah. That's when things change. Now all of a sudden, Abraham's name is given prominence. Why? Because Abraham does not sit back and say, hey, 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 do you know who I am? I'm Abraham. I'm 99 years old. I just had my circumcision. I'm a rich dude. I'm a prominent figure in the political landscape here in Israel. No. What does Abraham do? He personally goes and performs the mitzvah. He goes and gets the cattle. He goes ahead and he slaughters it. Not only that, he turns to his wife. He turns to his son and he gets them involved and he's giving them a message. I could sit back and get, I have servants who could do all of this. But no. The great personality myself, I'm running enthusiastically to do the mitzvah. Don't sit back and think it's below my dignity. I can just get someone to, I'm happy to provide. I'm happy to have guests, no problem. Jeeves, can you go ahead and, no, that's not how this works. For the performance of a mitzvah, I myself do it, says Abraham. When it comes to the needs of the guests, Avram's quiet. Does it anonymously, just gets their job, gets the job done, gives them what they need anonymously. It's not about him. But when he's encouraging his family members who could have thought, Dad, why are you doing this all yourself? Hire a mechanic. Go get somebody. You could, why are you doing? Because when it comes to the performance of a mitzvah, I myself do it, and I want you to do it as well. That's why all of a sudden now his name is used. He's setting the example for his family. Who is this youth, by the way? So it says he went to the tent, he had his conversation with his wife, Sarah, and he took the calf, and he gave it to the youth. That's all it says in the Torah. It doesn't say a name. Who is it? He only has one son at
this Isaac.
Who?
Isaac.
No, Isaac's not born yet.
No.
Ishmael, that's correct. It's Ishmael. Now you say, Ishmael? What? What's he doing over here? Yeah, Ishmael is 13 years old at this point. And he's teaching him a lesson. Rashi here on this verse says, why is he giving it to the youth? Because it is a critical lesson in parenting. You have to set the example. The expression, we all know this. You can't say, do as I say, not as I do. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Don't ever do that. It's a terrible message. You know what our children and grandchildren learn from that? You don't have to do it. Do as I say, not as I do. No, you have to do it. Set the example. Be the role model. So he goes ahead and he involves his son, Yishmael, in the process. This is how you do the mitzvah. Come join me. He didn't go ahead and sit on his lazy boy smoking a big fat cigar and say, hey, Ishmael, we got guests. Hey, go get the cattle, dude. No, he went ahead and he did it himself, teaching by example. I always say it's an ancient Chinese proverb, but it's not, but it's made up. I love it. And that is, when it comes to parenting, the child teaches, tell me, I forget. Show me, I remember. Involve me, I understand. That's the message here. Avraham doesn't just sit back and say, hey, let's get this mitzvah done. No, let's get involved so that you understand how important it is, how the right way to do it, all of these factors. So we now have two great lessons regarding how the Torah introduces us to this mitzvah of welcoming guests. Number one, anonymously. And number two is involvement to get everybody, you know, everybody involved by setting the example. And it's ultimately for the giver's benefit. But wait, let's analyze yet another detail of this story. It's really important. What does he tell them? They finally agreed to come into the house and to accept his offer of hospitality. Let some water be brought and wash your feet. Recline beneath the tree. Here's what I'm going to offer you. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourself. Then go on in as much as you have passed your servant's way. And they said, do so just as you have said. What does he offer? The basics, a little water to refresh themselves and some bread. What does he do in fact? Next sentence.
He gets a cattle.
Oh man, he's got Sarah baking cakes and delicious stuff, and Abraham's got the cattle and each one tender and good, and he's preparing it, and he's got milk and he's got cream and he's got the calf.
Today's work.
It's a three-course meal. All he offered was a morsel of bread. So two very important lessons. Number one, say a little and do a lot. General rule in life. Don't promise the world. It's a bunch of farfignugan. We all know when people promise all this stuff, right? You'll be lucky to see a piece of what they offer. Don't offer. Just say you'll do what needs to be done. Basic. And then do more. Go right ahead. But don't say more than what you can do. It's just silly business. But he brings them a three-course meal. And I think that that story with Rabbi Zonnenfeld really hits home to this point. And that is, Avraham understands that guests don't want to put you out. You don't like that. If you've ever been a guest in someone's home, you know, you don't want to just, you know, everything. I'll tell you a great story. When we lived in Columbus, so my wife is a nurse. And so for many summers, she would go for a month as the camp nurse in a sleepaway camp in the Catskill Mountains. We were living in Ohio, but she would go with the kids, of course, because can't leave them with dad. He's irresponsible. And go ahead and that she would go. So fine. So came Shabbos. She said to me, you can't eat alone. That's not, you know, go out. Go, you know, all the other families in the Kolo, they're happy to have you. And I'm like, I don't want to go. I'm happy just that. No. So fine. So we had a compromise. I would eat out Friday night and Shabbos lunch I'd have by myself. That was the compromise. And as wonderful as they were, and nobody made me feel bad, right? I didn't enjoy it. I felt like I was imposing on them. I'm just saying, we think we all have that feeling at various times. It's natural. Says the Torah, Avraham isn't going to sit there and say, oh, great, I'm so happy you're here. Let's sit down. We got chicken and we got corned beef and we're going to put together. Oh, and I have a new bottle of wine. I was just going to open it anyway. The guest doesn't want to hear that. They feel, you know, like you're putting them out. It's too much. Avraham says, a morsel, I'll get you some bread and some water. Just, you know, I know you're traveling and you are. That's fine. It's not going to make them feel uncomfortable. You're not promising them the world. That kind of sensitivity to when it comes to guests, that's what it is. We realized they would be hesitant. They wouldn't want to bother the host for the full meal. This is how you do it. We can begin to understand now one more aspect. Let's fast forward. We all know the story of Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah. Those two cities are destroyed because of their wickedness. Fine. But that's where Avraham was settled. He was not far from there. But after those cities were destroyed, the Torah says he went down south. Where it is? Let me find where it says this. After Sodom is destroyed, let's say it's fine. Here we go. Abraham, one second. Where does it say? Hold on. Vayita Eshel in Be'er Sheva. Where is that? Hold on, sorry, 1 second.
You need to Google it.
I know where what it is. I got to find where it is, though. I got to forget. Nah, I went too far. Here it is. Ha! So there, Wayne. I found it.
I knew you would.
Okay, Abraham, after the cities of Sodom and Amorah are destroyed, the Torah tells us, Abraham journeyed from there to the region of the south. He went down south. I don't think it was as far as a lot, but he went down south from where he was. A little bit further, it says the following. He planted an Eshel in Beersheba, in Beersheba, right? Which is definitely southern part of Israel. And there he proclaimed the name of Hashem, God of the universe. Okay, fine. What do you mean he planted an Eshel? What's an Eshel? So Rashi brings down, one opinion has it that that's the name of a kind of tree. And then Rashi brings a second understanding that the word Eshel is an acronym. It stands for Aleph, Shin, Lamed. Aleph stands for Achila, food. The Shin stands for Shasia, drink. And the Lamed stands for Levaya, escorting. Food, drink, and escorting them. These are the three components of welcoming guests, by the way. When you have guests in your home, you provide them food, drink, and when they leave, you are to escort them out. You don't sit in your lazy boy and just wave and say, thanks for coming. You actually, I didn't say you can't sit in the lazy boy now, Arlene. He can sit there. Don't give Mara time. I said, when you have guests that are leaving, it's not appropriate to stay in the lazy boy. You should escort them out. Make sure that they know how to get to their next destination. That's part of the mitzvah of welcoming guests, those three components. So Rashi brings down that Avram travels south and he sets up basically a hospitality suite. He sets up shop down south. Why does he move down south? Because there's no more travelers. Sodom and Amorah were just destroyed. Nobody's walking that way anymore. So he's like, okay. I would have said, if this was, you know, Abraham Tuchman, it would be like, oh, thank God I can retire. But yeah. Okay, but that's, you know, thankfully our patriarch was a heck of a lot better than Tuchman. And he travels down south because his job's not over. And what does he do? He sets up a place, Eshel, Aleph, Shin, Lamed, Achila, food, Shasia, drink, Levaya, escorting. Makes sense, right? Here's the problem. Of the three, food, drink, and escorting, which, if you had to rank, which was the number one component of the mitzvah of providing hospitality, you would have said?
Food.
Food.
But it's probably escorting.
Because otherwise, why would I ask the question?
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting Wayne to say drink because he's thinking of a hard drink, not a soft drink. But that's the most important. However, the truth of the matter is that Talmud states explicitly, Levaya, escorting your guest out is the top of the chain. More important than the food and drink. Not to say that the guy comes in and goes, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Let me escort you out without food and drink. That's not, I know, Chuck, that's what you were thinking. I read it all over you. However, I know my peeps. Okay. But no, after providing food and drink, you have to escort them out. Why? Why is that so critical?
So your house
love it. Love so it, house love it, love it. You know why?
Being hospitable.
So the house won't burn down.
No. In our house, we joke and we say we escort them out to make sure they don't come back.
Well, I was always told it keeps your house from burning down.
Okay. I mean, there might be some deep mystical thing to that. But just from a simple understanding, I love this concept. When you provide food and drink for this guest, right? What you're doing are fulfilling his or her needs. They're hungry. They're traveling. They don't have. You are fulfilling their needs. When you escort them out, you're honoring them, not just their empty stomach. You're showing great honor and dignity for the person themselves. That's a whole different level. You're not just, you're showing care for the person, not just for their needs. What happens if the person comes in and says, I just ate? So you don't have food and drink, but they want to talk for a little bit. So fine. So you talk to them. Doesn't that show more than just the food and drink? It shows that you value them as a person, not just they have a need to talk or a need for food. When I escort them out, it says, I care about you as a person because you're created in the image of God. And you deserve my attention, and I want to make sure that you are fine. That's a much higher level. Yes, Arlene.
Okay, so you have a guest comes in, you feed them, and you're very happy that they're there, and you usher them to the door, and he turns around and says something, you know, that food was like, okay, needed a little bit more pepper. You're like so happy to do this mitzvah, and then the person isn't that appreciative, has a negative comment.
It doesn't change what you did. The only thing that changed is that they have to work on their character trait of being more appreciative. It doesn't change an iota of you. They're missing out on something. That's on them. You did everything you were supposed to. You not only do you get full credit, you did the right thing. You're a better person because of it. Their lack of appreciation or their lack of benefit in their eyes doesn't change the fact that you did it.
Right.
Doesn't change it one bit. Here's an example. What if somebody says, you know, I'm going to say, here, Fred, I'm going to go to 7 Mile Market. I'm going anyway. Right. So I'll give you a lift. Let's pretend for a moment. Right. I'll give you a lift. Right. Is what I provided for you so amazing? No, I was going anyway. No, the answer is, number one, I did what I was supposed to. And two, this addresses your point, Arlene, that Fred needs to show appreciation. Why? Because you needed the ride. I was going anyway, so it's no skin off my back. But you benefited, for goodness sakes. You have to show appreciation. But that's on them, Arlene, not you. It doesn't detract an iota from the fact, okay, so you'll know for next time, put a little pepper in. That's fine. But it doesn't, you didn't do anything wrong. You did everything right.
Can I just want to make a comment because it just something just struck me. So Craig and I are delivering food to somebody whose wife just went through a surgery tomorrow. You know, we signed up, it's a list, whatever. And I had a call to try to confirm it today. And the person said, you'll love this, Rabbi. The person said, Craig said, I'll be over to deliver. They said, is Robin coming? And I said, I'm not sure because he's coming from work and I'm not really sure. And they were more concerned if I was coming like to stay and talk to them versus the food that we're dropping off.
Exactly the point. Mm-hmm. Escorting your guest out is giving credence to them as a person, not just their needs. You're showing honor to the person. And therefore, that's why the Talmud says that over the three categories of what we provide for the guest, food, drink, and escorting, escorting is the highest level because it addresses the person, not just their needs, not just their empty stomach. Okay, that brings me to two last points. Understanding this mitzvah of achnasas archim, of welcoming guests, as we've said, you know, it's under the larger, more general topic known as chesed, as kindness, which has many categories. But I want you to understand. And I really started with this, but I want to bring it out a little bit more. The prophet Micah, right? There's a prophet Micha, where he uses the term and he encourages the Jewish people. And he says, I want it to be that you become asot mishpat, to do justice, va'ahavat chesed, and loving kindness. Do justice, love kindness. And the commentators are all bothered. Why don't you use just one verb? Do justice and kindness, or love justice and kindness. Why two different verbs? One says do justice, and the other is love kindness. Is it not sufficient to do justice and do kindness. The great Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, passed away in the early part of the 1930s, made this following point. The Torah is not satisfied if you do chesed, you do kindness. That is not the highest level. That's not enough. Not enough to do it when it's necessary, when it's asked, or more likely when you can't get out of it. That's often when we do the kindness, when we have no alternative. When they say, you say, it's really tough, you know, try someone else first. And if not, call me back. Really? Really? That's really jumping at an opportunity. The Torah is telling us, avas chesed. You have to love it to the extent of where you pursue it. You create the opportunities. Don't wait for them to ask. If you perceive someone in your neighborhood, you perceive someone that you know that has a need, don't wait for them to ask. You should love helping, love kindness to the extent that you will do it on your own. Don't wait for the phone call. Don't wait till they're desperate. Justice, it's either a do or don't. I don't have to love it. I don't even have to like it. It's the right thing to do. Justice is a black and white. Justice is a right and wrong. But not when it comes to chesed. When it comes to chesed, when it comes to kindness, of which our example tonight is welcoming guests properly, pursue it. Love it that it's in your kishkes, that you can't wait for the opportunity to do it. Who's the example? Who's the prototype? Abraham. That's our story. The man is 99 years old. He's recovering from pretty major surgery at that age. And he had plenty of servants to take care of for his travelers. But that's not. When you love to do, when you love to help, you seek the opportunity. He's sitting at the entrance waiting for it. He goes ahead and he runs. I mean, I can't imagine. 3 weeks after my surgery, I'm still hurting. 3 days after, he's running to get the cattle. He can't wait for them to come. Yeah. Go ahead. You got to love it to the extent that you seek those opportunities and you actually create them. Finally, we have one white, big elephant in the room. How do you overcome the barrier of why I don't do it? Because I don't have enough, and now fill in the blank. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. I don't have the ability. I don't have, how do you overcome? Because that is a natural tendency of why we don't do as much as we should. I don't have this or I can't do that. How do you overcome that? Beautiful idea. There is a concept, we talked about this once upon a time, of something called ma'aser. Ma'aser means a tithe, a tenth. It's not limited, by the way, to our produce. It's not limited to our money or possessions. The Torah actually talks about it. If you own a herd, you own a flock, you have to give ma'aser behema. You have to give a tenth of your flock. You have to give it to the temple. You have an offering to bring. You have various things, all newborn animals. What? How do you figure that out? There's a system. All newborn animals from that year walk through a narrow passageway of where they go single file, and the owner counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Number 10 marks with a little red dye, little paint or whatever that, you know, we're not branding it, but just makes a mark on it so it knows to collect it. And then again, keep going. And for every 10th one that you make a mark, great. When you're finished having them pass single file through that passageway, then you know how many you have and you take those. Okay. Rabbi, you're a smart guy. I'm sure you could have figured out a better system. Why go through this whole process? The farmer knows how many newborn animals were born that year. Let him take a total, divide by 10, and then give it. It's a very simple equation. Why go through this? Can you imagine the guy has 100 new flock this year, 100 new sheep? He's got to take the time to have them pass 100 of them, one at a time. Keep good records. You know 100 were born. Done. I'll give 10 to the Beit HaMikdash. I'll give 10 to the temple and I'll bring it as an offering. The answer is because a person will likely say in that scenario, what? I got to give so many animals? Oh, come on. That's a lot to ask of, man. That's really a lot. 10? I don't want to give 10 away. But when they go through single file and you have to count and you say, 1 is mine, 2 is mine, 3 is mine, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 are mine. Okay, 10, that's for the baby. 1, mine, 2. You're counting 9 blessings for every one you have to give away. How brilliant of a process is that? You get your bank account, you get your check, and you're like, I got to give how much away? Taxes? What? And walk, walk. You start choking. But if you have to count it out in the old days when you got cash, 1, 2, 3, 4. 500, 600, 700. I like how I switched that. 800. You're counting your blessings every day. Okay. It's not so hard to give out the 10th one. That's how you do it. You're right. Who has time for this? Who has money for this? Who's got the strength for this? You're right. But how about taking stock of all the blessings we do have? Take a good look at everything that a person has, how truly blessed he or she is, makes it much easier to give to others. Much, much, much easier. Love that concept of having them go single file because you're counting your blessings. Oh, you got to love this Torah thing. It's just fabulous. So this is my message for the evening. Okay? This is what we got. We got this beautiful mitzvah of Hachnasas Archem, of welcoming guests. It's, as I said, under this concept of chesed in general, but what we need to do to really do it right is we have to work on ourselves to inculcate within ourselves that love of the opportunity to do it.
Come on.
It's not just a checklist. Yeah, okay, I got to do it. I have no choice. No. Seek the opportunities. There's no question. There's not a single person on this call, on this class, that doesn't know someone that would appreciate an invitation. We all know some. Don't wait for them to ask. Don't wait for them when you see them. Go do it. Seize the opportunity. Don't wait. Be the Abraham. Be the Abraham that's waiting patiently to find that opportunity. And then go ahead and seize it. That is really what's expected of us for this mitzvah of Hachnasas Archem. Any questions?
Was it, it's not, I guess it's like a semi-question comment. I think, I remember, maybe we were talking about other mitzvahs, that you said when you do a mitzvah, you don't just do the bare minimum, you go above and beyond and make sure you do the best you can do. So is that sort of what we're talking about with the guest too, where he offered a little bit, then he gave the best that he could?
I think it's more than that. The concept of taking things, beautifying it, and doing the best you can is already the higher level. You're right. You can do the base. You can do the basics. I'm not saying that you can't do the basics, but if you truly love it, you're not going to be satisfied just doing the basics. If it's something that you truly enjoy, whatever it is, whatever hobby you enjoy, you don't just do the basics. You spend time with it. You mull it over a little more. You get the best kind of the camera. You know, you want to try this. Why? Because it's you're passionate about it. You love it. That's our attitude. That's what it needs to be when it comes to doing these mitzvos. When we do it, then the Torah encourages us to do it in the best possible way. But I'm talking about the stage before of the attitude of loving the opportunities to do it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Candy.
Yeah, I read about a really wonderful mitzvah today. There was a gentleman that was selling a dryer on Craigslist, and the woman went to get the dryer, and she just had a baby, and he was asking $500, and she said, is there any chance you could take $400? And he said, yes, I'll take $400. So she was really happy because she didn't have hardly anything. And he helped her to get the dryer into whatever she was driving. And when she got home, there was a message that said, always check the dryer vent. Yeah, always check the dryer vent before you wash. And she thought that was a strange message. And she thought, she went and checked the dryer vent, and the $400 was in the dryer vent. Now that is a great mitzvah.
Yeah. It's funny, I don't remember where, but I had seen that story. But you're right. I mean, this goes in line very much with this concept of being aware and being attuned to the sensitivities necessary for those in need. This guy understood that this lady didn't have anything. She desperately needed a dryer. Okay, so she'll figure out somehow how she'll scrape together $400, but she didn't have the money to spend. And he understood that. And this was his way of helping her. It's a beautiful, beautiful idea. Love it. Susan.
This might be in the neighborhood of Hachnasat Orphim, but it came up in the initial question that you asked me. You asked about what I, you know, right.
Would you sell your mitzvah?
Would I sell my mitzvah? So yesterday, a beloved member of our shul passed away, Avrida, who embodied Hachnasat Orphim. This woman, anyone who was blessed to have come in contact with her for two moments would remember her and the way that she was. Just amazing, luminous soul. So anyway, I made a paid a shiva call to the family, and when I've had this experience before, I had it very deeply yesterday. I felt so uplifted after making that visit. I felt, and I almost felt badly about, like, when you talk about is this what you talk about with the fruits that you can feel? I did not go to feel right. That. I did not, that was not my intention whatsoever to go so that I would come out feeling as right. I did, but I couldn't, it provided this amazing opportunity to just be with her family
right.
And receive, you know?
I don't know if that's really the literal fruits that we get, the dividends of feeling good about it. I don't know if that's, I think the Mishnah is even much more tangible, but there's no question that the satisfaction we feel when we give of ourselves, right? Because you went to give of yourself to feel their pain, to share in their suffering. In the end, it fits in line. The more you give, the more you are able to receive that good feeling, that you become a better person. It's so, again, I say this all the time. The mitzvos in the Torah are designed to make us better people. It's not just a checklist of making us meshuga. It makes us better people. And the more we give and give and give, the better we become, which is the greatest recipient. It just, it has that effect on us. Yeah, we can probably go around the room and have everybody, because we all have experienced that in one way or another. It's a great concept. It really is. Fred.
I'm glad you read that portion of I read that every morning for the morning prayer. And you made me understand it even more. I knew that, you know, we don't understand, some is for this world, but the world to come. But you gave me the fuller meaning of it, because I used to interpret it. I was looking for another, you know, what the full interpretation was. But it's
hey, that's my job. That's
I know. I am trying to give a compliment, which is meaningful.
Thank you.
And I meant it, but I also, I used to do that with jobs I would do. I mean, I would do something for someone, and I realized I charge by the hour, but you know, I want to spend some time. I can do a great job. It's going to take me 4 or 5 more hours. I can't charge them for that. I want to see if I can make this come out a certain way. And I would pour myself into doing this thing. Well, Sharon knows what it takes to do what I do.
Yeah.
And I never told them, you know, I just said, you know, whether they saw what I did or not, it didn't matter to me. Right. It's I did something beyond what they were asking for.
Yep.
And I didn't even say, you know, I spent twice as many hours and I didn't charge you for it. I just said, you know, this, you know, I hope you enjoy it. I mean, that's me. That's me.
Well, it's an important idea. I think we can all learn from it. And, you know, just to wrap it up again, I'll finish with what we started with. And that is, who is the ultimate beneficiary? It's us.
Yeah.
We, the giver, are the ultimate beneficiaries. Remember the story of Ruth and Boaz? The terminology she used is the one for whom I did today. Why? Because Boaz was the greater recipient by doing that mitzvah than Ruth was for the parched grain that she got. That's the message. All right. Any other questions?
You know, when I used to in Miami, we recorded the donations that were made during the high holidays, but it's amazing how many were anonymous.
Right.
And I used to wonder, but as you were talking, I realized these people are doing this. They don't want to be recognized for what they've done, but they want to make sure they're doing it. And that's kind of the principle you were bringing out at the beginning.
Yeah. Maybe in a different class, we'll talk specifically about tzedakah, but the same principles apply. Same principles.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right.
Thank
everybody
you.
Have an awesome rest of the week, and I'll see you
hopefully. Oh, Sheila Blank says hello, by